Associate Professor of Management and Management Information Systems at Cal State University at Bakersfield. We'll turn the time over to him now to present his paper on the faith of a social scientist, and I guess we'll just play it by ear. If Merrill shows, we'll give him a chance to respond.
Okay, yeah,
there you go.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Although with Leonard Arrington in the next room, I better amend that introduction to say it was social economics. I didn't study any of this business type stuff until I got corrupted in graduate school. I was just thinking that the Mormons are really a peculiar people. It's probably the only group where it's the liberals that would get up early for an extra day at church to get here. And I assume some people will be filtering in. I was lucky to get here on time. My wife and I slept through two alarm clocks this morning. Let me also begin by saying that when this was developed, I'm going to go ahead and I prepared a text, but basically I turned more of a presentation discussion into a paper. So if you have a pertinent comment that would make the presentation more interesting, or if I can clarify something, or you disagree, go ahead and jump in. Let's be a little less formal on this. And I'll also give, although she's out parking somewhere, I'll give my wife some credit. There are a lot of the ideas that are from her that are in this paper, even though I only have my name on my copy here. Okay. This paper began as a presentation for the Miller-Eccles study group in Southern California. I was asked to give a presentation on fairly short notice. I'm assuming I was a fill-in, because given the speakers they usually ask to that group, I was a little shocked but honored to be asked to present there. And the topic was left up to me. I decided to do something which would reflect my training in organizational behavior, and which would tie in several of the topics I had treated previously. This I failed to do. But I did choose a topic which forced me to reflect on some issues which have been very troubling to me personally. And I got an updated copy there. Respondent just walked in, for those of you listening on the tape. I have always been attracted to Joseph's teachings that whatever principle of intelligence man attains in this life will rise with him in the resurrection, and that the glory of God is intelligence. Many of us are proud of the facts that the Nauvoo City Charter called for the establishment of a university, that universities and schools were established very early in Deseret, that Utah leads the nation in many measures of educational attainment. We recall the establishment of the schools of the prophets and elders. Many of our church leaders, such as B.H. Roberts, Orson Pratt, James Talmage, and Dallin Oaks, have attained, and there are others, have attained both prestigious degrees and respect in academic communities. I personally had several role models at BYU who were pillars of faith to me, men who were learned and brilliant, and one woman, by the way, and still remain true to the faith. But in preparing my presentation, I reflected on several events in my life. Not that only one was learned, I just had one female faculty member at BYU. Which was Eloise Bell, so I'm kind of messed up from that anyway. But in preparing my presentation, I reflected on several events in my life which have made me wonder if academia and the institutional church are on a collision course. One of these events was a BYU fireside in which Apostle Boyd K. Packer explained the root cause of homosexuality. He summed it up in one word: selfishness. As a, quote, good Mormon, I tried to understand this claim and follow the logic of his arguments. However, as a good student, I was troubled by his reasoning and came away perplexed. Much later, I began attending Sunstone symposiums and was dismayed to hear of the aversion therapies attempted at my alma mater while I had been attending. As a PhD student, I had many long philosophical discussions with an LDS faculty member and psychologist. He was not nearly so comfortable as my BYU science professors had been with issues of faith. These conversations contributed to my eventual conclusion that it was very difficult for an LDS social scientist to remain faithful. Leonard Arrington was a man whose work I greatly admired and whose faith I did not question. I was very troubled by his dismissal from the position of church historian. This event reinforced my perceptions of a general distrust on the part of church leaders of professional history, psychology, and other behavioral and social sciences. One bishop I had was an anthropologist by training. I don't know how common that is, but I always thought that that was kind of... There must not be very many with graduate degrees in anthropology. Unless they make David Knowlton a bishop one of these days, which I'm wondering about. He also has had struggles with faith and testimony issues. He deals with them by avoiding discussions of and thinking about difficult issues. This is the approach to many questions which my wife feels comfortable with, and that's I gave you credit at the beginning, Janet. Even though Bonner Ritchie, an organizational scientist at BYU, doesn't remember this, he told my wife's freshman seminar how he approached difficult questions. He explained that he asked himself if the answer to the question would affect the way he would live his life. If not, he would try not to worry about the question. This approach has never worked well for me. At another symposium session, I heard presentations by two psychologists/therapists from BYU. One was LDS, the other was not. The LDS therapist had apparently successfully fused his views of religion and psychology. During counseling sessions, he would give priesthood blessings to heal patients and cast out evil spirits. I feel that he may have been guilty of abusing his role as a therapist in order to protect his own faith. Yet in stark contrast to the above experiences is my experience in a course I took at BYU after my mission. It was an honor seminar in science in which we studied biology, physics, and geology all in one course. Series of courses, actually. The net effect of the class taught by faithful professors was to convince me that there were no insurmountable contradictions between my religious faith and findings in the physical sciences. As I pondered these thoughts, and I'd say kind of a stream of consciousness, jumbling of thoughts at this point, and other experiences in my life, the apparent contradictions were troubling. How could so many of my experiences testify that the church and church members embrace truth and knowledge in every sphere, and yet so many others seem to lead to the opposite conclusion? How could a people who embrace higher education so firmly be so seemingly anti-intellectual at times? This is a paradox which has troubled me for a long time. In order to address this question, I thought of the circumstances surrounding my choice of educational discipline. My love of the study of organizations is largely rooted in my love of the church and my experiences as a member of the church. My studies have helped me to more fully understand my experiences from primary years to mission service and beyond. What I have learned has in many ways strengthened my faith and reinforced my testimony. I've been able to view potentially troubling individual and group behavior and phenomena in the church setting as ordinary and expected in any organization of similar size with similar characteristics. I have shared my perspectives of organization theory applied to the church setting in the form of Sunstone presentations. I find the process to be valuable for the practice it gives me to apply theory in my academic field and for the peace it brings me to understand that many of the things I find troubling in my church experience are common to all organizations. And let me say at this point, I might add that I've even been guilty of taking Sunstone into Elders Quorum presentations when I've been an instructor and using that to supplement the manuals. I don't do that anymore. I guess it's because of the ward I live in. Well, I'm not asked to teach anyway, but I think it is somewhat ironic that I've come to be viewed by some of my faithful church friends and the Strengthening the Members Committee as a threat to the church. My quest for knowledge, well, maybe I better backtrack, is we referred to Levine already, and last summer I gave a paper that was entitled A Line for the Lord. I don't know why that would be controversial, but a couple of the reporters from the Tribune asked me for copies of my paper, and lo and behold, a couple of the selected portions appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune. The same week, an article I'd written some years before finally appeared in Dialogue, and this past fall I was called in to answer. There was a letter that appeared over the sigil of the apostles transmitted through the area president to my stake president, and I found out later on to my bishop. But in contrast to the experience of probably 99.9% of the people who've been called in, it ended up being a very nice experience for me. I had a very pleasant interview with my stake president and came away feeling better about him and my stake than I had before going in. But I realize that is the exception. My quest for knowledge and understanding of organizations was driven by my desire to help the church grow. I sincerely view myself as an apologist for the church rather than an opponent to its teachings, or at least most of its teachings, I suppose. I believe that my presentations on the church as an organization offer a way to view some of the troubling or undesirable behaviors of individuals within the church in a context which makes them both understandable and less threatening to faith. Others, however, have found even my desire to study the church as an organization or my willingness to apply the principles of social science as problematic at best. They tend to classify me as a troublemaker for my efforts to explain many church-related phenomena as mundane rather than spiritual. My BYU and subsequent experiences in Henry Eyring's book, The Faith of a Scientist, hence I assume you all got that allusion, have convinced me that it is possible for scientific exploration to be compatible with church belief, testimony, and active participation. The rub comes in the particular scientific discipline considered. I am most convinced that there is compatibility with the physical sciences such as physics, chemistry, and geology. My level of conviction fades a little when we move into the realm of the life sciences, such as medicine, genetics, and biology. It fades a lot when sciences are considered. Hence my title, The Faith of a Social Scientist, Is It an Oxymoron? Before attempting to answer that question, I would like to propose a little historical perspective and start with just a little thumbnail sketch of my limited understanding of the physical sciences. Again, this is heavily contributed to by Janet. Since the beginning of recorded history, men and women have sought explanations for the physical phenomena which they observed. As the body of scientific increased, so too have explanations given by religious leaders changed to accommodate new information. The accommodation has not always been smooth or uneventful, however. In early societies, the roles of mathematician, scientist, philosopher, learned individual, and religious leader were played by the same groups of individuals. Every society has sought to understand natural occurrences. From the earliest day, man has been fascinated by the motion of the stars in the heaven and has sought to understand God by understanding the way in which planets moved. A learned caste of priests arose which predicted the changing of the seasons, held the knowledge of the cycles of weather, and offered explanations of the perplexing physical events which were observed in a harsh and seemingly unpredictable world. Earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and periods of drought or flood were attributed to God, or many gods, reacting to the actions of the individuals living in the communities. Religious leaders held the understanding to living lives that would please God. As a matter of fact, let me digress again here. And since Leonard Arrington is next door, he wrote along with several co-authors a book about the settlement of the valley surrounding the Little Muddy River in Colorado. Somebody refresh me if that's the right one. Anyway, northern Arizona, excuse me. And the cycle went something like this. Every 7 years or so, the members of the church would lose the faith and become corrupt, and the Lord would punish them with a flood. And then they would rebuild the dam, and for 7 years they would become steadily more corrupt as the dam would silt up, and then it would flood again, and they would be issued a call to repentance and would rededicate them to the church, and had the cycle of tying physical events to spiritual righteousness. It is interesting that the legal profession still utilizes the term act of God in describing physical phenomena. These explanations developed by the religious leaders were usually complex and unapproachable to the common person. The explanations also had a mystical or spiritual component to them. Even the early physical scientists who were not a part of the religious hierarchy tended to create complex views of the physical world in which logic, reason, and observation blended with the spiritual. An overview of the progression of thought in one area of physical science, that of the forces governing the motions of the planets, may be illustrative. As early as 300 BC, Aristarchus? Not? Okay. Had proposed a heliocentric model of the universe. The proposal was largely ignored. Copernicus, back in the 15th century, argued that all planets, including the Earth, moved on concentric circles about the sun. In order to have the theory match the observed motion of planets, each planet was thought to move in a circle with smaller circles, cycles and epicycles. This helped explain the observed backward motion of planets. Complicated patterns of motion had to be memorized for each planet in order to understand the universe. However, the model of the universe that was most widely accepted for over 1,000 years was that proposed by Ptolemy before 200 AD. He viewed the universe as a sphere with the Earth at the center. The stars were all fixed on the sphere and rotated around the immovable Earth. This was supported officially by the Catholic Church, Martin Luther, and Jewish leaders. In this model, the hand of God was obviously needed to keep the system in order. This intricate universe implied the existence of a powerful, intervening God. Its complexity made it at once unapproachable and provided the opportunity for religion to provide dogma to make sense of it all. At the age of 45, Galileo heard about someone building a telescope. So he ordered some lenses and built one himself. When he discovered four moons rotating around Jupiter, it shattered the idea that the Earth was the only fixed object around which all other objects rotated. Galileo continued to make observations which shocked the religious leaders of the day. Kepler, in the 16th century, originally proposed a different version in which the six known planets moved on concentric platonic solids, thought to be perfect enough to have been picked by God for such a creation. But he eventually changed his mind and, using data from Tycho, developed the currently accepted point of view. Newton followed and helped explain gravity and planetary motion with the universal set of laws known as the laws of motion and Kepler's laws of planetary motion greatly simplified man's understanding of the universe. Because their discoveries occurred at a time when they had only a few years of mathematics, the basic ideas could be mastered, they caught on with students around the world. The ideas were much more accessible to many more than just the elite few. At this point, the churches of the day could no longer ignore the findings, sweep them under the rug, or deny them. They were too widely accepted, and they too effectively described heavenly phenomena. Eventually, the attitude of beauty in simplicity was adopted. That is, the simplicity itself began to be used as evidence of God's hand. God became the great creator of a beautiful and simple universe. We just had to understand the laws. Scientific findings regarding the motion of heavenly objects had become respectable and had even been embraced. No mainstream Christian church is currently opposing the heliocentric model of the universe. Life science. As mankind's understanding and mastery... Boy, let's open up the... Mastery of the physical world has increased. It has allowed for more time to be devoted to pondering the origins, essence, and development of life on Earth. Even more attention could be focused on the causes of death and longevity, why crops failed, and how nature arrived at a balance, and what happened when that balance was upset. Discoveries could be used to increase health and welfare by cutting down on disease and improving sanitation and yields from crops. Mendel's discoveries of peas passing along information to subsequent plants was invaluable both for agriculture and husbandry. Still, valuable as this understanding was, it encroached upon the domain of religion. This conflict can be seen clearly by considering the reaction to Darwin's theory of the evolution of species. Even though Darwin and other early life scientists were typically possessed of religious faith, their fields of study and the implications of their findings were threatening to the church. By offering an understanding of genetics, circulation, cell functioning, etc., these early pioneers helped us to understand what had before been one of the most unapproachable topics, life itself. When the evolution of species was added to the mix, no wonder organized religion vehemently opposed these new ideas. They appeared to offer no place for God in understanding the mystery of life and the existence of such a rich and diverse cornucopia, boy, early in the morning to say words like that, of life on Earth. Taken to the extreme, it may also have appeared to offer an alternate explanation for the initial beginnings of life. Just as with the physical sciences, however, not every fundamental question has been answered by the life sciences. Gradually, Christianity has come to accept more of an initial and less interventionist role for God in the creation and propagation of life. Social science. This analysis had led me to believe that there has been an evolution in the relationship between the physical sciences and religion, which began with conflict, then led to acceptance of some findings, and finally to a change in the religious dogma. This cycle has repeated itself with the life sciences. The social sciences are relatively late arrivals to the scene. It was only in the 19th and 20th centuries that Freud, Durkheim, and other social and behavioral scientists began to delve the mysteries of human behavior. For this reason, they are the sciences which are currently in conflict with religion to the greatest extent. And let me say here, I didn't know when to stop and point this out, but you know, this is a very Eurocentric point of view on things, obviously, and I believe that this kind of cycle of conflict and accommodation, finally embracing, probably will occur eventually with all religions. I just am not knowledgeable enough to speak about the Eastern religions with any degree of confidence, but I suspect that the same things are happening, just that in many of these societies where literacy is not very high, where many of the Eastern religions are the predominant ones, religion has not been forced to confront these findings to the extent that it has in the Western world. The conflict between science and religion. All of this brings me to the question, what is the nature of conflict between science and religion? I once went to a fireside in which a noted, LDS physical scientist spoke on the topic of science and religion. It soon became clear to me, however, that he chose to frame the topic in a very different way than I would have done. He viewed the topic of science and religion as encompassing the reconciliation of the findings of science with religious dogma. I viewed the topic from the point of view of a coexistence of two different ways of knowing or proving things to be true, one based upon experimentation and observation, the other based on faith, study, and inspiration. I am very optimistic about the possibility of reconciling scientific findings with religious dogma. I am very pessimistic about the prospect of religion and science peacefully coexisting as ways of knowing the truth. Yet, a perspective that seems to dominate discussions of science and religion and is the one I will focus on. I believe it is the fact that science has held out simple, understandable explanations for phenomena which have not necessitated a role for God, which is at the heart of much of the science and religion conflict. Let me propose three events which are symbolic of the cycle of conflict between science and religion within the Mormon context. They are Galileo's trial, the evolution controversy at BYU, which was interesting. It was either in this room or the one next door where there's a presentation on Chamberlain, who was forced out of BYU for his views, by the way, by the father of the LDS psychologist whose long philosophical discussions with me kind of threatened my faith. it's a real close circle in Mormondom. There's all these connections. And the excommunication of Fawn Brody. Galileo's trial happened well before Joseph Smith came along. Indeed, Joseph's view of the universe encompassed a heliocentric solar system and Kolob-centric subcosmos. You all get that? Kolob-centric subcosmos. What I guess is, you know, our God has part of the universe that goes around Kolob and all that rotates around, but there must be other main stars out there somewhere. Yet it is interesting that it is only in the past few months that the Catholic Church has admitted that it made a mistake in trying him for his science. Recently, this past year, BYU issued statements attempting to clarify its official approach to the teaching of evolution. It appears that the Mormon Church still hasn't formally admitted making a mistake opposing the teachings of evolution or firing the faculty who did so. In the matter of the excommunication of Fawn Brody, it appears that the Church still doesn't think it has made a mistake, and that some other historians and social scientists may deserve her fate as well. Let me reiterate that. It's only been in the past year that the Catholic Church admitted making the mistake regarding the physical sciences. This past year, BYU still hasn't admitted it made a mistake in firing people for teaching evolution. And I really don't believe that very many people in the official positions in the Church believe that it made a mistake at all in excommunicating Fawn Brody. These events are symbolic because they demonstrate both the chronological order of conflict between the different scientific fields and religion and illustrate a cyclical pattern of conflict. The physical and life sciences have already advanced through a cycle of schism, conflict, and accommodation with most Western religions. Social science is still firmly in the conflict stage. This paper is an attempt to understand why it may be more difficult for social scientists to reconcile their science with religious faith for physical and life scientists. Our everyday lives and beliefs are relatively unaffected by physical phenomena. While the occasional hurricane or earthquake often precipitate an upsurge in religious exploration and faith, we live in a world in which mankind has seemingly mastered the land, the oceans, and the skies. It is an existence that would be incomprehensible to our forebears only a few hundred years ago. Even though the physical sciences have failed to offer answers to some of the questions most fundamental to our existence, the fact that the resulting technology has insulated us to a large extent from the vagaries of the physical world, which has resulted in a world in which faith, at least faith in an interventionist deity, is less necessary. The same thing can be said about the findings and insights of the life sciences. While the debate rages about when human life begins and who made the first DNA, most of us take genetic engineering, miracle drugs, microsurgery, in vitro fertilization, etc. in stride. We take comfort in the ability of the technology associated with the life sciences to clothe, feed, and cure us. Again, faith in a deity which minutely controls the processes governing life is less necessary than ever. In our modern society in which we have tamed the earth and achieved both a longer and more comfortable life for ourselves, issues of motivation, intention, and causation in social settings have replaced issues more central to survival and comfort as worthy of our attention. Our leisure time has allowed us to attempt to tackle societal issues in which the enemy is ourselves rather than the natural world or microscopic organisms. I find it interesting that the most popular television show, which gives us a glimpse of our possible future, has recurring themes dealing with social... Oh, well, they can't hear that. I don't know if you can hear me. And behavioral issues. I'll have to buy that tape. Star Trek, The Next Generation, almost downplays the technological developments of the future to focus on issues of conflicting cultures, belief, friendship, etc. And it was interesting when we were at the Eccles group, an actor from the series was in the audience, and we talked at some time about that. And it really, if you think about that show, if you happen to be devotees of Star Trek: The Next Generation, it's amazing how little time they actually spend on these wonderful contraptions, and how little time and how much time they spend on exploring issues of interpersonal relationships and the problems that we face in society. It's kind of science fiction is a vehicle for examining current social issues. At the root of the, and I believe, although I'm not very well read in Mormon science fiction, I've gotten the impression that that's true of Mormon science fiction as well, and maybe all science fiction. At the root of the conflict between science and religion are both the progression in the sciences. Oh, and let me backtrack again. And I believe it's because they mastered the physical and life science realms that allowed them the luxury to be able to concentrate on these issues. in the future as well as today. At the root of the conflict between science and religion are both the progression in the sciences and the evolution of religious thought. Concepts which were initially presented dogmatically as complex, difficult to understand, and miraculous were eventually understood through science as being elegant and simple at the abstract level. This trivialization of the laws governing the universe, the origins and evolution of life, and human behavior have taken their turns being threatening to Christianity. An interesting aspect of the progression of the sciences is that as science progresses, theory becomes increasingly elegant and approachable at the abstract level, yet require increasing amounts of formal training and background to understand at the fundamental level. For example, while many of us probably feel there are no findings in the physical or life sciences which directly threaten our faith, I don't know if that's empirically true or not, but I just threw it in there. It is unlikely that any person in this room has the background to understand quantum mechanics and the mechanism by which DNA influences cell differentiation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. While it is common to hear people deriding simplified or unproven theories of human behavior as, quote, pop psychology, it may be even more common for us to believe in pop physics or pop biology. On the one hand, the sciences have taken turns threatening religious dogma by trivializing human experience. On the other hand, our limited and often erroneous understanding of them has become a religion in and of itself, replacing some of the functions of religion by offering a view of the world which is simple and free from ambiguity at one level, and which at a more fundamental level contains mysteries which require a type of priest caste slash scientific elite to understand. You know, I always had faith. Let me give you an example that borrows from the social sciences. I remember years ago reading Hugh Nibley, and seeing these footnotes and allusions to ancient cultures and languages and all these things that were just completely unapproachable to me. I didn't understand. I wasn't in the habit of reading footnotes at that time or endnotes. But it really buoyed my faith to believe that, well, there's someone who understands it all and yet can present this conclusion that seems to support my faith. I believe that we often do the same thing with the physical and life sciences as well. As an aside, it is interesting to me how Mormon theologians have historically borrowed simplified concepts from the sciences and include them in their view of the world, but eschew or simply ignore many of the logical consequences and complexity of those concepts. This would be an interesting topic for another paper. But back to the cycle of conflict in Mormonism. Eventually, the Christian church backed down on its opposition to the Newtonian view of the universe. Christianity as a whole, and the LDS church specifically, have come to accept the creation of life, a view of the creation of life, which does not require God's intervention in every conception. But I see relatively little accommodation with the findings of the social sciences within the church, with one possible exception being the acceptance by most that mental illness is caused by forces other than demonic possession. Of course, the study of mental illness can be considered an extension of medical science as much as being in the realm of psychology. And forgive me for that in the back row, Glenn. I slander psychology. It is largely because the social sciences are relatively immature and have not refined their theories and models to the extent the physical and life sciences have that it is more common for church leaders and others to assail them. However, once they mature and provide more elegant, simplified answers to social and behavioral phenomena, the opportunity may be provided for theologians to reconcile the findings of the social sciences with dogma. That's one reason why I really like Isaac Asimov. He believed that all behavioral science would eventually be folded into mathematics, that mathematics held the key to all science, which my wife, I'm sure, enjoys, but I find incomprehensible. Yeah, it makes sense to her. The trend toward an accommodation with the social sciences may be beginning already. The Research and Evaluation Division of the Correlation Department relies heavily on social scientists to gather and interpret data. Church leaders have backed off a bit on dogmatic explanations of homosexuality. Bishops are now counseled to refer individuals with behavioral or emotional problems to professionals rather than focus on spiritual disease. I believe this trend is likely to continue. Yet I also believe that difficult times are ahead for social scientists. It seems to me that we are at a stage where most church leaders believe that social science and social scientists are threatening their legitimate domain. Issues of belief, motivation, inspiration, and cause and effect of behavior still pervade Christian religious dogma. Since my field is organizational behavior, I would like to propose a couple of examples of theories and findings which may appear to be in conflict with religious dogma. Since organizational behavior borrows from psychology, sociology, anthropology, etc., it is rich with examples. For example, the principle of cognitive dissonance postulates that people feel discomfort when their avowed beliefs and values come in conflict with their behavior. people attempt to alleviate this discomfort by either altering their views and beliefs or their behavior. A social scientist might believe that if an individual continues to bear testimony from an early age, that individual's beliefs and values must change to accommodate that behavior. Church leaders may offer a more faith-promoting explanation. As we bear testimony, we are obedient, which in turn leads to a spiritual confirmation. This applies to keeping the commandments in general and developing a testimony as a result. It also applies to adhering to the ordinances and other ritualistic activities in the church, in particular praying and fasting. I won't get into that unless there's a question. I developed a paper which traces the church's progress through the same stages of growth that all organizations go through to one extent or another. This model predicts the appearance of leaders such as Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Harold B. Lee, and Gordon B. Hinckley, and others to fill the needs of a particular stage of growth. To some, this may appear to conflict with the notion that the Lord selects leaders to meet the needs of the church at a particular time. Groupthink, a phenomenon first described by the psychologist Irving Janis in observing the workings of the Kennedy administration, may better describe how many decisions are made in the church better than the model of mutual inspiration. I believe it offers great promise for understanding phenomena such as Mountain Meadows and the lobbying efforts against the ERA. The problem many people have with using organizational behavior as a lens through which to understand a religious organization is that it appears to offer, quote, mundane explanations for phenomena, which in their minds negate the possibility of divine influence or processes. The fields of sociology, psychology, anthropology, and history are replete with such examples. In conclusion, I want to reiterate my major point. While I don't believe that we will ever be able to reconcile science and religion as ways of knowing, I do believe that religious dogma, or our understanding of that dogma, if you will adapt to encompass irrefutable scientific findings. Social scientists will eventually become respectable, just as physical and life scientists are now respectable. The problem is that it may not happen in my lifetime. Does this mean that physical and life scientists of today and social scientists of the future can easily reconcile their faith with their science? I think not. There will always be an internal conflict experienced by religious scientists from every discipline due to the inherent differences between science and religion as ways to discover truth. But as religious dogma adapts to encompass scientific truth, it becomes more comfortable to be a scientist belonging to an institutional church. Finally, back to the question which was the genesis for this. Is that a proper use of the word? Which gave rise to this presentation. Do I believe it is difficult? It was late at night when I was editing this. I believe it is difficult or even impossible for a social scientist. Do I believe it is difficult or even impossible for a social scientist to be a faithful church member, a true scientist? If you would have asked me that question a few months ago, I probably would have answered no, it is not possible. After developing this paper, my answer would have to be that it is difficult, but will eventually become increasingly so. Because of this conclusion, the process of developing these ramblings has been of great value to me. I hope that I have presented some ideas which may have been which may be of value to you. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Merrill Oates. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Pennsylvania, and was previously a international relations and anthropology major at BYU, and in fact taught there the year before that they hired Dave Knowlton. And so following a number of these questions that have been raised about the possibility for social science and faith coexisting, I've been deeply personal and have been something that I've been very involved with and very significant. And I appreciate the comments of John on you know, approaching this and asking this question that you know, are there some fundamental contradictions here that that ought to be dealt with, or can they be dealt with? Maybe is the real question. If it took several hundred years for the Catholic Church to reinstate Galileo, how long will it be before Dave Knowlton's canonized? Maybe a while, huh? And yet, as an anthropologist, I find that it's not sufficient to simply say that we can, as your bishop might say, well, I'll deal with those later, or those aren't immediately concerned. Because I see the social experience that I encounter in the church as something that has direct correlation to those things that that I have studied. And I think along with John, it was my discovery in anthropology of explanations of things as simple as the ritual and ceremony of a pygmy initiation tribe that that paralleled in so many ways in its fundamental organization my missionary experience. And I presented a paper on that at Sunstone a year or two ago. There are some connections here, and we find in social science an explanation that it focuses on causality, on explaining our social experience. And this is something that I see in a presentation that is why we're encountering the conflict with contemporary Mormon religious dogma, is that it also is focusing on this social experience and the meaning and the motivations behind why we do things and why things happen to us as individuals. I think it's illustrative to go maybe a little bit behind some of your comparison on physical science and to realize that some of the philosophy that was behind this, that religious ideas were from the beginning at the core about. I mean, Genesis was a description of the creation of the earth and the material world. And so this was seen to be core to religious belief and explanation. You know, why the crops failed, why the flood happened, etc. And then physical science comes in and provides an alternate explanation. And so, yes, you have a direct conflict. What's interesting is to see exactly what you pointed out is actually a transformation, a change in the religious dogma that removes that physical. It's not so relevant of, you know, when the comets fall and when the floods happen. Yes, in our sacrament meetings, we offer prayers for the people in the Midwest who are suffering floods and that, and you know God has a role in that. But there's not seen an act of causality. There is a recognized that well, the rain falls because of these physical factors, and so you get floods. And it's not simply a reduction. We no longer accept in our contemporary belief, a simplistic, well, God was mad at the people in Iowa, so he's flooding them. They've been evil this week. We're beyond that, which is an interesting change in theology. You have fundamental change in theology. One thing that I thought was interesting that you pointed out was the different approaches to the ways of knowing things. I wanted to offer a caveat, though, on your interpretation of social science. And even extend that to what I think we see today in physical science as formerly an approach to, well, there's a truth out there, which was the same ideology that religion had, and we've got to discover it, and that can be discovered through revelation and through the biblical texts. Physical science had that same idea for the longest time of, well, there's a reality out there, a truth, a little black box, and we've got to go find it. We've got to dig out and ask the right questions and poke the right prods, and we'll figure it out. Modern physical science, it seems in some ways to have gone beyond that with contemporary physics. I mean, take just a simple example, the Heisenberg principle that says you can't know a particle or position and velocity or its movement at the same time. Why? Because in measuring one, you change it. In the presence of the observer begins to alter that reality that is out there. And that the very aspect of asking questions begins to alter because of the assumptions that you come with and because of your approach, that it alters what it is, what results you find. And if that's recognized in physical sciences to a degree, how much more so when you have social sciences, which I really am hesitant to try to draw parallels there, because when the object that you're studying is yourself and you realize that you keep moving around and you keep changing, you know, how much more flexible and how much more contingent is this upon how you start the questioning? And so I really am hesitant to give social science some credit for discovering truth out there. Rather, though, I do accept that it can discover principles and you can find commonalities and you can find patterns. And this is where those patterns, then we give explanations, and that's where we encounter the debate and the controversy with LDS theology when a historian goes back and says, well, these are the reasons and explanations given for this principle back then, whether it be polygamy or whatever else, and now these are the explanations we have now, And you can take the text and you can say, something's changed. We're giving different reasons for this. There's a different experience here where a sociologist can look and find patterns of behavior and patterns of belief that depend maybe more on social economic circumstances than on whether the person, you know, prayed that the evening before. Anthropology, you know, finds in the experience of religious belief that how cultural assumptions will differ and change the interpretation of an event. These then are questions that are dealing with the causality and the motivation and the experience and interpretation of individuals, the meaning that they give to the world around them in a social context. And here's the change, why now it may be acceptable for physical scientists to believe and to do their real physics, because religion has detached itself from giving explanation to the social, to the physical events, while sociology or social sciences have at their core finding explanation for the things which contemporary Mormon theology is still trying to define those reasons. And therefore, you come up with different conclusions, different explanations of that causality. And I think that may be more at the root of it. And I think we will and we do continue to see changes in the in our theology and in our approach and interpretation of things. But I don't know how much leeway and how far that will go. I mean, if the LDS theology is to become a gospel of social practice, as many mainline Protestants have, or in the idea of liberation theology, of it's not so much what how we explain things of the relationship of God to individuals, but what we do with it as individuals and how we carry out this matter, then there's a lot more room for accommodation, because you don't have these inherent conflicts of why does this happen to me, what made this happen, what role did God play in involving me and other individuals. But there's much more of a recognition of autonomy and that how the individual is somebody that is making these decisions and therefore can be explained through the process of social science analysis. I think that kind of rests as the key, some of the what I see as some of the conflicts and you know, the possible resolutions. I simply see that there will be a continuing debate and discussion until there is, you know, wider recognition within the church and within the populace that, yes, there are other explanations out there, and just as we accept that the flood came because there's weather patterns and the rain fell, so we will, I think, come more and more, although the debate will be heated and long, to realize that that there are real sociological and interpersonal factors that influence people's belief and religious experience, and I hope that debate and that effort to try to understand it and expand that will continue, because it's at the point where people cut off the desire to understand and cease to accept these explanations, as I find when I have discussions with my dear brother who just returned from his mission. You know, his causality is very clear. Everything happens because of this, and I point out alternate possibilities, and they don't always sit well. But he's come around to a point to acknowledge that there's something there to discuss, and let's hope that continues. Anyway, thanks.
I'd like to thank John and Janet for that paper, and also Merrill for his comments. What we're going to do now is open it up, and they want to get the questions on tape. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring the mic to you, ask your question, and then I'll try to run. Yeah, wait, I'm the deacon. Or Oprah. Let me see if I got enough cord here before I run out here with it. And then I'll try to run back up and give it to the person who's going to respond.
John, I have a question for you. I don't accept your faith in the idea that ultimately there'll be some kind of accommodation in the social sciences for this reason, and I'd like your response to this. In the physical sciences, you have something to point to. You can point to the rings of Saturn. You can point to bones in the ground. I can't point to your id, okay? I have no, there will never be something, some kind of physical evidence to show that kind of insists on an explanation. And I see no particular reason why we couldn't go on with without reaching that stage of accommodation indefinitely, simply on that for the lack of you know, compelling physical evidence. Asimov was a great science fiction writer, really lousy psychologist, and will never really get, I see no reason to believe, after, you know, as a psychotherapist, that we'll ever have that kind of compelling physical evidence that would kind of compel a sort of rapprochement.
Yeah, that's a real good question, and I appreciate it. I guess I can only offer as evidence Star Trek The Next Generation. You need to watch it a little more diligently. No, and again, I'm hoping that there are some unanswered questions with this paper, because it's only interesting if you put up a straw man that can be shot down. Again, as I was, the cause of writing this paper, what caused me to write this paper, is that I saw many people who I consider to be faithful, good scientists in realms outside of the social sciences seem to do fine, and the social behavioral scientists in the church didn't seem to do well. And so so thinking back, I tried to decide why that was, and I think, at least in my own mind, I discovered this pattern. And I'm looking for the future. I'm trying to crystal gaze here, and I guess I'm just being... But I do view the possibility. But I also appreciate Merrill's observation that maybe it won't have to be reconciled. Maybe in the future, maybe what they do in Star Trek, and maybe what we'll do is say... And I cut it out of this version of the paper that he had, but... So maybe we'll just go to a buy-your-fruits approach, the liberation theology or social activism, where you say, well, all right, we don't understand all the cause and effect of human behavior and motivation, all the rest, but what is important is what we do with that faith and that belief. And so maybe we'll never reconcile it. I just don't know. But that's what happens when you look in the future.
I do see that's a difficult thing, because physical science, you've got something there that you keep bumping your foot into, and we can debate about what it is, but yeah, there may be with social science, we're dealing with merely constructs and definitions that by their nature are continually shifting. There isn't a there out there that we can put our hands on to call society, even though we pretend we're always talking about it. And so religion also, as it really stands, is talking about definitions and interpretations of things that, by their nature, don't have the grasp, the hardness that you can bump your nose on. But I think it's, I think we're dealing with a different ballpark, and I hesitate to make the parallels between physical and social science, because I think the high school word social studies is almost much more applicable than pretending that it's a science sometimes.
Well, before you say that, I got to point out that I do teach a graduate class in statistics, so of course we know the truth. We can prove.
I teach that same course.
Yeah, okay.
John, could I push you to apply your theory to a very specific phenomenon, and that's the one of homosexuality in the church, homosexuality among believing Latter-day Saints, and the ways that you feel, the ways that you see the church is trying to deal with that, and whatever shifts and developments and other things you see going on.
I'm probably not the best one to address that, because somebody who's dealing with sexual counseling and therapy and that type of thing would probably be better. But as far as my thoughts on that matter, I think Boyd K. Packer has backpedaled, maybe not in behavior, but at least in speech. He doesn't attribute, or at least the explanations aren't simplified. And this also encroaches in the realm of the life scientists, because now they're doing this in vitro experimentation, but they're looking at what happens with hormonal levels and all that in the womb and some other things. So I have some hope that maybe the sciences will gang up together to give an alternate explanation to homosexuality that doesn't include selfishness or just pure evil. But I guess I don't know what's going to happen. I just see that, they don't give shock therapy with pornography anymore, and I think that's at least progress. You know, it shows that they're at least thinking about the issues. Levina, go ahead. Oh, yeah. Assuming that eventually we come to a generally accepted understanding for the cause of homosexuality that does not include spiritual disease or wickedness, what will happen? I really believe that the church will accommodate to that. I mentioned this in many discussions, but the Tanners, who most of you are probably familiar with, wrote a book, a great stinging indictment of the Mormon Church called The Changing World of Mormonism. Well, the beauty and the strength of the Mormon Church is that it has adapted over the years and accommodated. I think it's a ringing endorsement rather than a condemnation. And so I remain faithful. And again, if you look back, put yourself in the shoes of the people in the 19th century. And the things that we believe and reconcile with our faith today would have appalled many of them. At the level of the Book of Mormon, regardless of whether you believe it's an ancient document or Joseph's influence is felt there, you see Nephi, offering proof of God and the fact that there are stars up in the heavens and they move. You know, we maybe still believe that, and it's still proof, but we understand it in a different way, and we've come a long way, and maybe we will with homosexuality and other social phenomena as well.
Well, if the church's views change and accommodate to new realities that are discovered by science, does it call into question the validity of the idea that we can get truth through divine revelation? If science comes out and, let's say, proves that something that has been believed to be divinely inspired truth is falsehood, does that give us good reason to question the idea of divine revelation? Let's take the idea of the devil. I spent quite a bit of my life reading in the social sciences, and I don't believe in the idea of the devil. I believe the idea of the devil was born in Persia, if I remember correctly, in the Zoroastrian religion, then passed down to the Mithra religion. And I believe that it was used to scare people into being good. And yet, in Mormonism, I've been taught the devil is caught in a struggle to get control of our minds, and we must guard against him. But to me, I can't accept that. And I wonder if the fact that we have such ideas as that of the devil calls into question the idea that divine revelation is a valid source of truth.
Yeah, let me say that, yes, you should worry about that and the conflicts. But I do appreciate the viewpoints of Merrill and other people trained as anthropologists in that there is no objective reality. You know, we always have to examine the cultural milieu in which we perceive things and understand things. And to some, discovery of DNA passing on characteristics and rather than, God's direct intervention in determining hair color and those things may be threatening to faith. On the other hand, the elegance and the beauty and the wonder of the functioning, the chemical, biochemical properties, to me, can also testify and provide faith. You look at Joseph Smith's view, and was it Section 88, where he talks about the planets are held in their courses by this light of Christ. I think it's a very beautiful, elegant explanation of the universe. And maybe it's just that as we learn more, we understand revelation more fully, and we go back. Now, I know relativism is always uncomfortable, but I really believe I'm getting winding out too far, but I really believe that I don't know of a single contradiction that can't be that obviates the possibility of revelation being immutable and containing truth. It's just our understanding of that which changes. And I think if you remember back to my paper, I try to be careful to say our understanding of eternal truths or dogma may change rather than the dogma itself. Enough said.
Let me just. Some of us do revel in our relativism, and enjoy the kind of the warm and fuzzies of explaining these things in a social context. And I think what our problem is is this very concrete materialistic understanding of truth as this like little black box that's out there. And if physical science in a lot of ways is getting beyond that, I think social science really can come to understand things as part of context. I don't find that necessarily contradicts the essence of scripture or revelation, because that can be just as valid and acceptable as something relating to a social context and a social environment. And we can learn something from it because of what it teaches people and what they do with it, not because it's an absolute and immutable something that's reality and always will be, but that it can have messages. And this is, you know, one of my attractions initially to anthropology is it said, well, there's myth out there that it doesn't matter if, you know, this tribe sprang from the big toe of the elephant. What does that tell us about the group idea of these people and how they feel that they are united and what they will do with this? The truth of its original event is not relevant, but what is socially done with it. And I think that's where we see the real meaning and the significance of whether they're religious or philosophical or social ideas.
Okay, to keep everything on schedule, we need to conclude this session. Can we?
Because we started late.
Okay, why don't we do that? We'll take one or two more questions.
I was going to muddy the waters a little bit as a sociologist. I was raised the son of a physicist whose heroes in the church were Widsell and Talmage and Mariner Merrill and Harvey Fletcher Sr. And so I grew up thinking that God was the great physicist. And then after my mission, I went to BYU and got into social psychology. And then I had the good fortune to get into, accidentally, not knowing in advance, the most radical sociology department in the country. And after a couple of years, I passed my written exams and then had my oral exam. And my committee chairman, for those who are sociologists, happened to be Alvin Guldner. And the first question he put to me was, how can you be a Mormon and a sociologist? And for the next hour, we discussed that. And one result was a study I did on the social psychology of scientific theorizing. And after 25 years, I've come to the conclusion that God is a great sociologist. And the result, I guess, is one that I find within the social sciences a remarkable degree of understanding about the humanness of the Lord's church. At the same time, I find remarkable support for what an inspired and revealed social organization and culture it is. Out of that comes a serious question about two things. Doubt that we'll reconcile the unknowable and unknown and incomplete knowledge we have in this world. I remember when I first started college at the University of Utah, there was a physical chemist who had theories about he didn't call it plate tectonics at the time, but, you know, the division of continents, and he was practically laughed out of the university by all the geologists. Before I'd finished college, plate tectonics and continental drift were the established theory, and today you'd be laughed out of the business if you didn't believe in it. I've seen in sociology, in the social sciences, however, we don't get major paradigm changes over time. That is, we don't have evidence that we have multiple paradigms, but we don't have evidence, be it the physical or something that we can palpably feel, that overthrow theories. The best explanation, the best descriptions of society today may still be those written in the 1840s and 50s by Karl Marx. We haven't improved in any significant degree on fundamental understandings because they don't come from the kind of research that a physicist or a chemist would engage in. But they can come just as easily from inspirational insight as from careful observation and so on. But because of the social constructed nature of these things, there will never be such a thing as an irrefutable social science paradigm or theory or finding that the church would have to say, we're confronted with this irrefutable fact. Now, how can you predict this sort of irrefutable type of thing in social science when there's nothing in the social sciences that is really anywhere near agreed upon in the same way that you'd find, say, 90% of physicists agreeing with parity in particle physics.
Yeah, well, let me answer that, but two things. One is you may not, and I don't know. The other is that I was at Nauvoo a few weeks ago, and boy, there sure is evidence of something good there, some of the goodness and truth maybe of the church, and the fact that the social phenomena that took place there was really quite revolutionary, and it's testimony to me. But as far as physical evidence, I don't know, maybe we'll never have it. But on the other hand, it's maybe arrogant to say we know what will happen in the future. You know, Durkheim, Marx, these others, Parsons, not very long ago that they were writing their books. So maybe history will make us look like, I don't know, make us look like the early physicists look to us today.
But maybe we have one more question. Somebody.
Okay. Well, do you want to flip a coin?
I know we never talk in absolutes. I think when we talk of humans, there are no such things as absolutes, and that's what makes us different. But Armin Ma, in the first presentation, alluded to the idea that the church used some very heavy research projects in organizing their current proselyting program. And that, to me, seems to indicate that they do recognize to some degree, and I don't know, what do you think, that the social sciences do have a place and that maybe we ought to pay attention to some of them?
Yeah, I'll just respond to it. I'm not in the in-group, but, you know, they do listen to Bonarici. He has access. There are other social scientists, Marie Cornwall and others, that are listened to. And I believe that that's very positive. That gave me some of the hope that maybe I hope was reflected in my paper that things will change and accommodate. And Leonard, do you have a quick one? Okay. If you say it quickly, then we'll answer it and get to the
next one. I'm objecting to your concept that the church has made accommodation with the physical sciences. I don't think the church does make accommodation. I'll give you three good reasons. One is, in hard science facts, I can give you seven reasons why the Book of Mormon is not a historical document. Now, do you think the church would ever accommodate with the fact that the Book of Mormon is not a historical document? I'll give you another one. I can give you hard science reasons why the current Mormon concept of God does not fit hard science. It doesn't. There are concepts of God that will fit, but it's not the current Mormon concept. I can give you hard science reasons why man did not stem from one person, Adam. Hard science reasons. I can give you hard science reasons why their origination had to be a lot longer than 7,000 years. These are all hard science. The church has never accommodated. I don't really think the church ever will.
How can there be no single Adam when science claims there's a single Eve?
Okay, just a couple of quick reactions. One is the fact that we don't talk about those things in High Priest or Elders Quorum, I think, is evidence that at least we've backed off on knowing, believing that we know all the answers. And as far as the Book of Mormon, boy, you know, historic or not, people, you know, that new book, The New Approaches to the Book of Mormon, I don't think we eliminate the possibility of inspiration and revelation in giving that book. Yeah, I'm sorry, Albert. just because of history. I think we can still say it was inspired, we just don't understand the process. And I think that's true with all the sciences. We can make the same conclusion.
Thanks to John. Thanks to Merle.